welcome to Lost in Science, 30 minutes of fantastic science. We've got an excellent show for you today. We're going into the past. I think that's what we're talking about today. With me in the studio, I've got Stu. How are you, Stu?
I'm very well.
Excellent. And we have Kate. How are you, Kate?
Hi, Lyndon. I'm good.
That's good. I believe the past is where we're going today, Stu. Is that right?
Yeah, so you may know that the home station of Lost in Science is 3CR in Melbourne, and the station is turning 50 this year. And as a consequence of turning 50, there's been a flurry of interest in old archival material that's been produced at the station over the years. One of the things that got dug up from the archives was a recording of a solar eclipse on the radio.
A recording of a solar eclipse on the radio. You're just going to give us some silence on the radio.
No. So back in 1976, there was a total eclipse visible from Victoria, and some intrepid travellers set out from Melbourne to the Grampians and basically recorded themselves watching the solar eclipse in 1976. So that's what we're going to have a listen to. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how much of the spectacular sight will be explained by the sounds that they caught, but there's a lot of people talking about what they can see and what they're expecting to see and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's a 50-year-old eclipse which is captured on audio.
Gosh, that sounds so amazing. Given the recent eclipse that was in Europe, and we've got a full eclipse coming up in New South Wales in a couple of years that will be visible from Sydney, I believe. It's very timely.
Maybe we should grab the field recorder and go and recreate the experience.
Not maybe. Definitely. That sounds awesome. And Kate, I think you might be taking us further back in time. Is that right?
Yep. I'm going to be looking at some of the inventions that volcanic eruptions have helped create.
Ooh, I'm trying to understand what you can create with lava.
Very, very thick umbrellas.
Evil lairs.
I guess you'll have to keep listening to find out.
Ooh. Let's go. Jump into your horse and carts. Let's get lost.
Around 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, October the 23rd, the whole of southern Victoria was witness to a very unusual scientific and astronomical event, an eclipse of the sun by the moon. A group of amateur astronomers and radiometers, led by VK3ZVZ, John Sved, the publicity officer of the Monash Astronautical Society, all went up to Mount William in the Grampians to observe the event. We took a portable tape recorder with us, and the result of the recordings is what you're about to hear. We're speaking to you from Hall's Gap, the dawn of the 23rd of October, Eclipse Day. Surrounded here by mountains, we have a situation of broken cloud. We'll be going up Mount William for the official eclipse observing point later on in the day. In the meantime, let's have a few interviews with those involved with the eclipse. Philip VK3BDX and Mark VK3ZMM. How did you get involved with this eclipse expedition, Phil?
Well, Mark really introduced me to it. He let me know what was going on and with the Monash Astronautical Society, and I seemed rather interested, so I came along. Just very convenient to come along with.
Are you providing any backup equipment facilities for the rest of the group? Any radio facilities? And will we be doing any radio experiments today?
I have arranged to try and get back to Melbourne through the Ballarat repeater. We don't know how we'll go, but it's always worth a try. We have got a 10-watt rig going at the moment into our 5/8 on the car, which we specially set up for this exercise.
We're talking to Mark VK3ZMM now. I understand you're doing some of the photography.
Well, yes, Chris. I've got a couple of cameras with me and fairly large telephoto lenses in the hope that we'll be able to get a few fairly good photographs of the eclipse. One camera will be shooting black and white, one colour. The black and white photographs are not for my own use. They're hopefully going to be used by one of the newspapers. The colour ones are just for our own use.
Are you using any sort of filter over the camera for the sun photos?
Oh, of course, during the partial phases, a filter is certainly extremely necessary, and I have had a special filter made, actually, a piece of aluminised glass, which with proper colour correction filters should give a fairly realistic-looking photograph of the sun in a partial phase.
What's the agenda for the rest of today, the 23rd?
We intend to be up there fairly early to get things set up because there is quite a deal of apparatus to set up.
Later that afternoon, we got up to the top of Mount William, the highest mountain in the Grampians, which commands a magnificent view over the whole of the Western District of Victoria, as far back as Ballarat and as far west as the South Australian border.
This is 3CR Community Radio Melbourne, broadcasting from the eclipse site on Mount William in the Grampians. The time is 10 minutes to 2 Eastern Australian Standard Time, and we're just waiting for the first part of the partial phase of the eclipse to commence. To my left is the telescope belonging to John Sved, VK3ZVZ, of the Monash Astronautical Society. This will be used for stop-frame photography during the eclipse. A speeded-up film of the eclipse is hoped to be made here today. There are various other telescopes and photographic equipment set up around me, and people wandering around, generally getting themselves ready for the eclipse, which is due in a couple of hours' time now. Tension is slowly mounting as we look across towards the west and we see clouds which are encroaching on the visibility of the sun. It's to be hoped that these will clear by the time the eclipse comes. It's 22 minutes to 4 Eastern Australian Standard Time as I'm speaking to you from Mount William, and the first contact of the moon on the sun's disk has occurred. The people with the telescope are busy tracking it and occasionally firing off stop frame photography cameras in order to determine the passage of the sun across the moon across the sun's disk. Weather here is almost totally overcast. It doesn't show any signs of becoming significantly less overcast. The sun is occasionally peeping out from behind the clouds. Don't know how effective our photography will be at this stage, but we'll have to wait and find out.
Well, yes, I see. Good news, everyone!
You're listening to Lost in Science.
The sun is just coming out from behind the clouds now, and we can see a very small section just at the bottom of it, cut off by the moon's disk. Cameras in the telescope have been set in motion. The telescope is now tracking the sun.
Right, hold.
As we continued to take stop-frame photos of the eclipse, we kept worrying about whether the eclipse would be visible during the total phase. John Sved continued to control operations from his post at the telescope.
John, don't you think you should be watching through that camera?
That's possible.
Because you know now, and you've got the control, you're the man who's got to drive it.
I'll drive it, okay.
Just keep it in sight.
Well,
it's a bit cloudy up at Mount William at the moment. We're getting the odd bit of visibility through the clouds as time goes by, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed that the important phases of totality will be visible. This is Mark Besley on Mount William at 4:06 p.m. on the 23rd of October.
Do you detect any, at this stage in the eclipse, we're getting a very thin crescent sun? Occasionally poking its head out from behind the clouds. We hope we'll get it sometime during the totality so that a picture of the corona can be taken. Also, some cameras are up here for the purpose of taking some pictures of possible comets that might appear when the sun is obscured by the moon. We can't see any great shadow across from South Australia, the direction of South Australia yet, but as we continue our coverage of the eclipse, The sun is now almost in the total phase, the time being 4:26 Eastern Australian Standard Time on the 23rd of October. A large crowd has gathered on Mount William to view the eclipse, and unfortunately the sun is only peeking out from behind the clouds every 5 minutes or so, so we haven't got terribly much chance of seeing the actual total phase of the eclipse as things stand at the present. It's becoming extremely cold, noticeably cold, and over towards the east, it's noticeably getting darker. The total phase probably hasn't hit the mainland yet. This will happen in about 5 minutes from now. As totality approached, the number of people standing around the telescope became dangerously large and it became hard to control them. Tactfully, we tried to get them away from the telescope.
It is getting dark, and that's not just because of the clouds.
We had our last sight of the crescent sun and then finally totality. The time is 4:32 p.m. Eastern Australian Standard Time, and this is 3CR Community Radio Melbourne bringing you a recorded coverage of the eclipse from Mount William in the Grampians. As I'm speaking to you here, the clouds have rolled in very noticeably. There's a dark shadow falling over all of the area to the west of here. Temperature is dropping very markedly. The power is connected to us from a transmitter building here on Mount William run by the Department of Transport, where also the amateur radio Channel 8 beacon, I think, the Western District beacon, I think it's Channel 3 actually, is transmitted from.
That's
fantastic out there
now. Look at that skyline here.
Sky is a noticeably strange grey violet colour. Presumably, this is the edge of the main shadow we're seeing now. Then suddenly, the shadow itself showed itself moving across the plain of the Western District.
John, if you look across there on that plain, is that shadow across there part of the shadow of the...
You better believe it.
Yeah.
It's
dark.
You can almost see how dark it is over there.
Yeah. We can actually see the edge of the shadow of the moon on the plain to the south of here, moving across very slowly. And it's very noticeably becoming dark very, very fast at the moment. It's actually possible to see the shadow moving across the plain to the south of here, across the pastoral country north of Portland.
Oh, you're not scared of dark. Just don't let Rob wander
away. There's a strange yellow tinge in the area north of here. You can probably see the edge of the shadow.
Nick off.
Hey, there's a light over there. Somebody's got the car light on.
Getting Bailey's beads now.
See, look at the light over there. Where there's not.
It's now becoming totally dark.
It's dark.
To the west, the horizon is...
Something.
To the west, the horizon is completely black. To the north and south, there's a weird yellow tinge coming through. I can see some lights about 40 miles to the south of here.
This is as dark as it gets.
Oh, yeah, but that's...
The strangest thing about this is the strange glow in the sky on the horizon to the north and to the extreme south. To the west, as I say, the shadow is still moving across. It's sufficiently dark now that people are having to use torches here at Mount William. The shadow of the moon falls, there's a large disk of cloud obscuring any chance of seeing the corona here, unfortunately. I can hear the amateurs busily testing away on their equipment. Temperature has dropped to, I would estimate, about 45-50 degrees here. And now there's a bright beige light coming from the horizon to the west. This will be the last total eclipse in Victoria this century. The next eclipse will be in 2031. We're now on the third point of contact. The sky is becoming noticeably brighter. And to the west I can see the shadow moving away. The sky, unfortunately, is completely overcast at this stage.
John Sved, who'd come 200 miles with his equipment to see the eclipse, was jumping up and down in anguish.
How does it feel, John?
Yeah, would repeat what he just said.
And we can look forward to our next one in 2031, perhaps with a bit more experience.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even
given any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lost in Science, and we're joined in the studio by Kate Bongiovanni. Kate, welcome back.
Thanks, Lyndon. Great to be back again.
You've brought us a kind of interesting fact today and a few stories. Tell us what you told Chris just before that blew his mind.
So I'm going to talk about how a volcanic eruption led to the invention of the bicycle.
Yeah, so now this, I'm assuming we're talking about a mountain bike. And it was someone who was needed to get away from a volcano really, really fast down the hill. Is that what we're talking about?
It's actually not, but I love that image you've created.
I don't know that you could invent a bicycle quick enough to get away from a volcano if you were in a hurry.
Yeah,
I know the urgency, the necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. You know. But let's find out. So, tell us the story. Which volcano? What's the mysteries we're going to solve?
Okay, so we're going to talk about an old volcanic eruption that occurred in 1815, called Mount Tambora, and basically, the eruption was huge. It was 10 times more explosive than the 1991 Mount Pinatubo eruption, to put it in context. And it sent 175 cubic kilometres of debris into the atmosphere, which is enough to bury the whole of Melbourne 20 metres deep.
Wow. Whoa. Where is Mount Tambora?
It's in Indonesia.
Okay.
And because it's in the tropics, this means that the circulation of the atmosphere can spread that ash and gas around the entire globe. And so then that is what has an impact on the climate or the weather around the whole Earth.
Oh, is this a famous year without a summer or something?
Yes.
Like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so basically what happened is, because all that debris and that gas was in the atmosphere, it kind of acts like a blanket and stops sunlight from coming into the earth. So then they got all this terrible weather out of season, like in summer, storms and snow and stuff.
How bad was it? Like, did it have big effects on people, on crops and people, you know? Yeah, everyone's
exactly.
Livelihood?
Yeah, there was a lot of crop failure, famine, people couldn't afford to buy food for themselves, let alone for their livestock, like horses.
Mm.
And so that's where this German gentleman, Baron Karl von Drais, comes into the story. And he invented this machine that allowed people to get around without the need for horses, which you have to feed.
Hay.
To feed hay.
Grass. Stuff. Feedstock.
Yes, you have to feed them.
Yeah.
And so, yes, he invented like a running machine or a Laufmaschine, the German name.
Yeah.
And so basically it's like one of those toddler bikes where you propel yourself along with your feet while you're sitting on it. And so that was sort of the earliest form of the bicycle, mm-hmm. and then it evolved from there. But it came from that need to not rely on horses and hay.
But I suppose this is a really good example of how much effect a volcano can have, or big volcanic eruption can have on the climate, which is something that we have, I'm sure we have seen this in recent history. Is that the case? Yeah.
There's been 5 major sort of climate altering eruptions in the last 200 years.
Okay.
And as I kind of touched on before, they've got to be in that tropical region to have a global effect so that they're impacting both hemispheres.
Oh, okay. There was that one in, I'm thinking about the Icelandic one, the Eyjafjallajökull, whatever it was called.
That's hard to say.
Yeah. That would not have had as big effect. Whereas something like Krakatoa in the early 20th century would have been a big one, I imagine.
Yes, exactly. Right. And Krakatoa is another one that I find interesting because that's what I studied for my looked into for my master's. And the impacts of that on the climate were quite big. You could feel them in Australia as well. We see a dip in temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And Krakatoa has also got a lot of, interesting tales. And for example, the Scream painting.
Yeah.
That
Edvard Munch.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the skies in that painting are red, and that's because of the impacts of the Krakatoa eruption.
Oh, seriously?
Kind of turning, those brilliant red sunsets.
Okay. Wow.
Which eruption was it that inspired or led to Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein. Was that Krakatoa as well? Or
that one was the Mount Tambora.
Tambora. I couldn't remember.
So it's that, again, that those awful storms and weather in across Europe.
Okay. Mm. So you mentioned Mount Pinatubo before. Where does that rank on this whole kind of volcano climate disruptors thing?
So that one, yeah, is also quite big in having a climate impact. Mm. I am not sure of the exact rankings and also not even sure exactly how, well, I guess there's temperature is what you could rank the climate impacts of them all. But they're all, so there's five, as I said, in the last 200 years, Mount Tambora, Krakatoa, Pinatubo was 1991, El Chichon in 1982, and Mount Agung in 1963.
Oh, that
kind of had, sizable global climate impacts.
Mount Agung, that's the big one in Bali. If you've ever been to Bali, you see it just dominates the landscape.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So what about something like a couple of years ago, there was the one in Tonga, the big explosion that sent a lot of stuff into the atmosphere. Was that, I mean, it was spectacular, but was that not as a big effect on global weather?
That one is quite interesting from my understanding. It's still being researched because it only happened a few years ago. But one of the things that it shot up a lot of water vapor and it shot up a lot of sulfur as well, I believe, way up into the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. So above where most of our weather happens.
Oh, okay.
And there was a study that was done by researchers at UNSW that said the impacts of that particular eruption will be felt in different ways over about 8 years.
All right.
And so there is some researchers saying that this very strong El Nino event we're getting at the moment is somewhat impacted by that eruption, just because it takes time for all of these different particles to be in the lower part of the atmosphere and the upper part of the atmosphere. And it changes the temperature distribution or the temperature difference between the equator and the poles, which can lead to disruptions in the winds and all of those kinds of things. So that particular eruption, is still a really interesting ongoing case study. But, I mean, some people see volcanic eruptions and think, woohoo, we've got a volcanic eruption, therefore climate change isn't a thing. But that's not the case, is it, Kate?
No, well, I think the key thing is that a volcanic eruption, it's not addressing the root cause of climate change. And so it might be able to lower the global temperature by a couple of parts of a degree temporarily, as you say, on those timescales of 5 to 10 years. But it's definitely not a fix to climate change.
So, we're talking, I guess, about all probably ash and stuff that's put in the atmosphere that blocks the sun. Are there gases that also can have the opposite effect? Like, can, say, CO2 be emitted from volcanoes?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess two parts. Just like Lyndon was saying before about sort of water vapor and sulfur, it is the gases that are having the big climate impacts because they are what hangs around, especially in the upper atmosphere for the longer periods of time, whereas your ash, those kind of particles, they actually get rained out earlier or due to gravity as well. And then on longer timescales, the CO2 that's emitted can have the opposite effect.
Right.
So I think the geologists who are looking at the really long-term changes would probably be able to comment more on that side of it too.
Yeah. But so volcanoes won't solve climate change, so it could make it worse, in fact.
Maybe on a geological timescale, but on the timescale that we're working towards, my understanding is that a well-placed, well-timed volcanic eruption would buy us a few years.
Right, okay.
But then the bounce back could be quite quick as well.
I've got nothing else. The only other thing I can think of is that it just reminded me that, you talk about geological timescales. I mean, volcanic eruptions can have major effects on the climate, having done in the past, like in paleo history. In fact, I think the end of the Cambrian period, or the end of the biggest mass extinction, I can't remember the name of it, that was caused by basically the Siberian volcanoes. This is not a good thing to talk about. I was going to say about massive climate change, it completely just changed the earth, but I cannot remember it all. Led to the extinction 99% of all creatures, but I cannot remember enough to So it was the end Permian, sorry, mass extinction. That's what it was, yeah.
I would say that on the geological timescale, volcanic eruptions can be responsible for big climatic changes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that is sort of how our atmosphere has evolved. Thanks to volcanic eruptions bringing up those gases from deep within the earth, that has allowed our atmosphere to have its lovely breathable components that we have today over time, over a long period of time.
Oh, but yeah, and certainly if you look back hundreds of millions of years, yeah, it has caused big changes like mass extinctions, probably a better way of putting it. and so, yeah, we can see from that sort of, from the geology how much of an effect it can have. So that's kind of a scary idea, though, that volcanoes could have that much of an impact. But like you said, it's mostly temporary. That will buy us a few years in terms of the larger scale of climate change.
And you can't see the bicycles in the geological record either.
If they were there, I'm sure you would see them. Yeah. I mean, but maybe it's still to be discovered.
Maybe the bicycle was actually invented earlier, but it kind of got buried in the ash from the volcano. They weren't quite fast enough to escape.
I've always wondered, was the unicycle invented first and then someone thought of adding another wheel, and that how bicycles came about? I don't know. Ooh. It's a question to ponder.
And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.